From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
It gives me pleasure to announce to the entire citizenry of New York that we have an agreement, we have a proposed agreement with the Metropolitan Transportation Authority and Local 100.
The Transit Workers Union in New York reaches a tentative agreement with the MTA, averting a strike by workers from the nation's largest public transportation system. Then, is cross-burning constitutionally protected speech or a threatening and provocative act of intimidation? We'll have a debate. And John Poindexter, should he get some of his own? The head of the new Total Information Awareness, electronic activists have published his home phone number, satellite photos of his house, and other personal information to protest the surveillance program. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Republicans with close ties to the Bush administration are saying Senator Trent Lott has no chance of remaining majority leader and that the White House wants him out. This according to a report in the New York Times. Last night, Lott appeared on the Black Entertainment Television station to appeal for forgiveness again for his civil rights record as a legislator and his recent comments supporting Strom Thurmond's pro-segregation run for president in 1948. On BET, Lott said he now backs affirmative action and recognizes the importance of Martin Luther King. Meanwhile, Republican senators have called for a private meeting on January 6th to decide whether Lott should remain majority leader. Several Republicans say they're eager for Lott to step down as leader, but do not want him to resign his Senate seat. That action might allow the Democratic governor of Mississippi to appoint a Democratic replacement for him, helping to tip the Senate back to a 50-50 tie. Senator Don Nichols of Oklahoma, who was the first Senate Republican to suggest that Lott should be replaced as their leader, has built a civil rights voting record that is nearly identical to that of Lott, this according to the NAACP. In 1983, both Lott, then in the House, and Nichols opposed a new federal holiday commemorating Martin Luther King Jr. That same year, both Lott and Nichols backed preserving the tax-exempt status of private schools, such as Bob Jones University, which then banned interracial dating. In 1990, the two senators both voted to uphold the first President Bush's veto of legislation to amend the 1964 Civil Rights Act to ban workplace discrimination. Across the country, hundreds of men from Muslim countries have been detained over the past week as they attempted to follow new government orders to register with immigration officials. Under a directive by Attorney General John Ashcroft, virtually all male non-citizens over the age of 16 from Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Sudan were required to register by yesterday with immigration authorities. The men were photographed, fingerprinted, questioned, and quite often detained. In Los Angeles on Friday, officials detained so many men that they ran out of plastic handcuffs. One immigration lawyer who used to work for the State Department told the New York Times the program compared with the roundups of Germans during World War I and the internment of Japanese during World War II. The Times reported that immigration officials were detaining men who had expired student or work visas or could not provide adequate documentation of their immigration status. Those who fail to report face criminal charges and immediate expulsion from the country. And the roundup is expected to intensify. By January 10th, men from the following countries must report to immigration officials: Afghanistan, Algeria, Bahrain, Eritrea, Lebanon, Morocco, North Korea, Oman, Qatar, Somalia, Tunisia, the United Arab Emirates, and Yemen. On Monday, the Justice Department announced men from Armenia, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia must also report. They have until February 21st. President Bush yesterday appointed former New Jersey Governor Thomas Kane to replace Henry Kissinger on the commission that will investigate the September 11th attacks. Kane has served as president at Drew University for the past dozen years. He's considered a moderate Republican by some. The White House praised Kane's close ties to 911 families. He serves as a board member from the firm Fiduciary Trust International, which lost 80 employees in the World Trade Center attack. But families of 911 victims have already criticized Kane's lack of expertise in diplomacy, immigration, intelligence, security, aviation, and other realms the commission will explore. The Washington Times is reporting President Bush has decided to begin deploying by 2004 a nationwide defense system against ballistic missiles. Bush is expected to announce the decision today. It comes a year after the U.S. withdrew from the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty to allow more effective research and development of a system to shoot down long-range and short-range missiles. It marks the first time since the 1960s that the U.S. government will field an anti-missile system. President Reagan first announced the major shifts toward strategic defenses and away from offensive nuclear missiles in 1983. A new report on Afghanistan by Human Rights Watch has found women and girls continue to suffer extreme repression, harassment, and restrictions of women's rights and police abuse reminiscent of the Taliban. Human Rights Watch is accusing the international community of double standards by justifying the war against the Taliban, in part by promising liberation to Afghan women and then supporting warlords and commanders who abuse women's rights. In other news from Afghanistan, four Afghan children were killed and three more injured when they were shot by U.S. Special Forces during a training at a firing range on Saturday. The Army announced yesterday it's investigating the incident. The children appeared to be playing in the area. Residents said they were unaware the firing range was in use at the time. In the West Bank, for the first time in living memory, the city of Bethlehem has announced it has no plans to put up a tree or decorations in Manger Square this Christmas. The city, which is 65% Muslim, 35% Christian, has been under curfew by the Israeli army since November 22nd. The army says it has no plans to withdraw before Christmas. The Palestinian Catholic mayor, Hannah Nasser, said, "We shall hold midnight mass on Christmas Eve, but nothing more. Our people are in no mood to celebrate." And in New York, a tentative agreement last night averted a transit strike by workers from the country's largest public transportation system. We'll have more on that in a minute.
6,000 Dixie Democrats snafu'd at Philadelphia hold a protest convention in Birmingham. Unofficial delegates from 13 southern states nominate their own states' rights candidates. South Carolina's Governor J. Strom Thurmond for president, Mississippi Governor Fielding L. Wright for vice president, will lead the fight against President Truman's civil rights platform. Governor Thurmond voices the South's feelings.
In the words of John Paul Jones, we have just begun to fight.
I want to say this about my state. When Strom Thurmond ran for president, we voted for him.
But I want to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that there's not enough troops in the army to force the southern people to break down segregation and admit the Negro race into our theaters, into our swimming pools, into our homes, and into our churches.
We voted for it. We're proud of it. And if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years either.
And admit the Negro race into our theaters, into our swimming pools, into our homes, and into our churches.
We voted for it.
And that was Joan Baez in our studio yesterday, singing along with herself, "The Day They Drove Old Dixie Down." And before that, a mix, thanks to WBAI producer and my colleague, Robert Knight of Trent Lott, and 2002, Strom Thurmond, 1948. In our second segment, we're going to have a debate on the issue of cross-burning. Is it protected speech or is it harassment and intimidation? And we'll look at some of George Bush's recommendations for the federal judiciary. But first, this news from right here in New York. A tentative agreement last night averted a transit strike by workers from the country's largest public transportation system. Transport Workers Union Local 100 President Roger Toussaint announced the deal last night, accompanied by New York City Metropolitan Transportation Authority officials.
It gives me pleasure to announce to the entire citizenry of New York that we have an agreement, we have a proposed agreement with the Metropolitan Transportation Authority and Local 100, which we are prepared to recommend to the Executive Board of Local 100 for approval.
We think that today marks a turning point in the relationship of the MTA and its unions. We want to go from confrontation to cooperation. We want our members and our workers to have health care. We want our members to get wages and improvements based on productivity. And most of all, we want our workers to be treated with dignity.
And that was Peter Calico, chair of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority. Before that, Roger Toussaint, the president of Transit Workers Union Local 100. In the end, the TWU assented to one of the manager's main objectives, a wage freeze in the first year. To soften the blow, the MTA will give each of the city's 35,000 workers a $1,000 bonus in the first year and 3% pay raises in each of the second and third years. The union also assented to measures designed to improve worker productivity. The MTA pulled back from a request that workers increase their payments into the pension fund, and the agency also agreed to increase its funding of health benefits by an amount the union estimates is over $400 million. In addition, the union won an overhaul of a disciplinary system that workers called overly punitive and tyrannical, and a relaxation of some of the MTA's stringent sick leave rules. Tension reached a peak on Friday when a state Supreme Court justice issued an injunction invoking the state's Taylor Law. That law bars strikes and calls for 2 days' pay for every day a worker was on strike. The judge also ordered union leaders not to incite their members to strike, but denied the authority's motion to prohibit union leaders from even discussing a strike. Worse, the city brought a lawsuit seeking $1 million in fines against the union on the first day of the strike, doubling each day thereafter. The suit also sought $25,000 from each worker, doubling each day, and $5 million to compensate the city for the expenses it said it had incurred on emergency preparations for the strike. Shortly before the settlement was announced late yesterday, thousands of transit workers marched over the Brooklyn Bridge and joined a coalition of teachers, municipal employees, and other supporters in a rally at City Hall. They chanted, "Make the crooks open their books," voicing skepticism about the $2.7 billion deficit the MTA claims it faces over the next 2 years. The MTA will end the current year with a surplus. We're joined in our studio by Mark Albritton, a track equipment maintainer at the New York City MTA's Coney Island Overhaul Facility. And as well, we're joined by Robert Snyder on the telephone, historian and the author of Transit Talk, New York's Bus and Subway Workers Tell Their Stories. He's also the director of Journalism and Media Studies Program at Rutgers. Well, first, Mark Albritton, how do you feel about the announcement last night?
Well, I'm glad that we settled it. Could we have gotten more, maybe? Did we get everything we deserve? No. But I think we did get what we fought for.
You're also the shop steward for about 700 members of the TWU. Can you talk about the kind of regime you work under when it comes to, for example, if you're homesick, what happens? What do you have to do?
Well, technically, I'm supposed to be homesick right now. So what I have to do is I have to call into my location and call off and tell them that I'm going out and where I'm going.
So at any point you leave your home, you have to call?
Every point you leave your home, you have to call. If you say you're going to one location and you change locations, you're supposed to call them again and say you changed locations. Vis-a-vis, if I'm going to one doctor's office, if I'm going to the clinic, Once you leave that doctor's office, you have to call them and say, I'm going to the clinic now.
Meanwhile, they are also calling you?
They can call you. You're supposed to leave a number.
Mm-hmm. Is this unusual? Let me ask that question of Robert Snyder, who wrote the book on the Transit Workers Union, to have this kind of, that's just one example of the system that was in place, which is why many are saying right now that beyond the issue of wage increases, dealing with these non-wage issues was vital for the TWU.
Have a long history of arguing that these kinds of work rules, these kinds of disciplinary procedures make their lives harder than they have to be. And there's a long history of contentious relations between the MTA and management and the workers who do the job of making the transit system run. And these kinds of questions of dignity and the ability to feel better about your work are always on transit workers' minds, and they have been going way back for decades.
Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of the history of the TWU, Professor Snyder, and also, in light of the fact that this is a national show, putting it in that national context?
Well, it was formed by activists in the 1930s under the leadership of a transit worker named Mike Quill. He was an Irishman. Many Irishmen were in the transit union workforce at that time. He worked with liberals, with leftists, with communists to create an industrial union for transit workers that was militant and in many ways quite progressive for its time. It struck for the first time in 1966 in the entire system and brought significant gains to the lives of transit workers. My grandfather was a transit worker. He worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, no paid holidays before the union came in. The union made a huge difference in the lives of workers, and the workers who are now in members of Local 100 build on that legacy. They proudly talk about it on their website.
Hmm. I'm looking at Juan Gonzalez's article that he did a few days ago on the transit workers, co-host of Democracy Now! Some of the facts: there are 34,000 transit workers in the TWU. Last year, the MTA filed 16,000 disciplinary actions, letters of warning, suspensions, or dismissals. That's one disciplinary action for every two employees. According to the current union contract, any MTA worker who calls in sick must report each of his movements while out of work. If he goes to the doctor, must call to notify the MTA. If he leaves the doctor to go to the pharmacy, must call again. Failure to do so could result in discipline. On top of that, agency investigators made more than 15,000 home visits and phone calls to check on sick employees last year. Fewer than 50 workers were caught feigning illness, according to union arbitration records. Is it any wonder Toussaint has charged that MTA managers think they're running a plantation? Coincidentally, more than 60% of the union's members are Black and Hispanic, and many of the rest are immigrants from India, Pakistan, and Russia. Follow the money, and then there's the MTA finances. Do you think that what we're talking about here is an issue of race, Mark Albritton?
I think it is. Right now I have a lawsuit against the Transit Authority, a civil suit pending, charging those allegations specifically. You know, I've dealt with cases, members written up, these are all Black members written up. One guy's written up for standing with hands folded in an attempt to avoid work. One guy was written up for laughing too loud. Another guy was subsequently terminated for not for this charge initially, but that was the first charge, was refusing to face the supervisor while he's talking to you. So that's very much true. It's very much racism. This whole thing started, basically escalated during the time when Robert Kiley and David Gunn were at the helm, and they brought in a lot of outside managers and started sweeping disciplinary changes aimed at writing people up, and they succeeded in doing it. They didn't write up half the workforce, you know, not under them, but, you know, over the last couple of years. They've succeeded in writing over half the workforce, you know, so.
Robert Snyder, you wrote Transit Talk, New York's bus and subway workers tell their stories, one story after another of transit workers. Can you, for listeners around the country, describe the conditions?
I was fascinated and amazed and a little bit frightened to discover how dangerous the transit workplace is. The repair shops are big enough in their own right with enormous amounts of heavy machinery in use, but it's the tracks above all that sort of fascinated me. When you go down on the tracks, you're in a dangerous and alien environment. It's dark, it's noisy, it's dirty. the tracks tangle in all sorts of directions. You put your foot in the wrong place at the wrong time. You could be caught in a trap as a train heads down on you. And we saw, tragically, what happened last month when two transit workers were killed working on the tracks. Transit workers perform dangerous jobs. They can die on the job just the same as firefighters and police officers. But the public rarely recognizes this. And I think that's one reason why safety was an issue in negotiations in this contract.
Mark Albertan, you are also a member of the New Directions group, which ultimately chose what people might call the most progressive labor leader in New York right now, Roger Toussaint, as your leader, and won the election. What was New Directions?
I wasn't a card-carrying member, although I was an avid supporter and attended many meetings. New Directions was a movement that started in the early 80s. With a few people in RTO, which is Rapid Transit Operations, and it spread quickly to other departments. And our department, track department, was one of the earliest supporters of New Directions, and that's how we came to elect Roger Toussaint as our chairman.
You worked side by side with him before years ago.
Well, I didn't physically work side by side, but I was side by side with him as far as fighting disciplinary actions, going to arbitrations, supporting the track committee as a shop steward.
And then overall, Robert Snyder, as if we can make some connections to the international political scene right now, U.S. war about to invade Iraq, a war many believe is over oil, the need for these kind of fossil fuels in this country set against a mass transportation system, a way to cut down on that kind of usage. Can you talk about New York City and its transportation system in the context of other transportation systems?
Well, New York City has the biggest mass transit in the country system in the country by far, and the people who ride on it help us keep off fossil fuels, help us move more efficiently using mass transit. And transit workers play a vital role in making that system run. The more effective use we make of mass transit, the less we have to use fossil fuels, the better off we are in all respects. Transit workers and the people who ride on the transit system are doing patriotic duty.
I have to say, Mark Albertan, watching the television this weekend, I think we find this with transit strikes or threatened strikes around the country. Almost all the news throughout the day on every single network was about the inconvenience that this strike would mean. I never heard the issues laid out of what the strike would be about.
Well, they're never going to lay out the real issues, because if you laid out the real issues, it would be clear that we were in the right, clear that we deserve everything we were asked for. And I saw one article comparing us to bus drivers in other cities, that bus drivers at transit make the highest. Anybody in the right mind knows that anybody in New York City makes higher wages than people in other states with smaller systems and smaller populations. So that's a very unfair comparison. But the issue as far as pensions reform, you know, they want us to pay 2.3%, you know, which right now we're paying 2%. And on top of that, we've been paying, in essence, paying for our own pension. The issue was restoration of the health benefits trust, which was $45 million in the red. And we're threatened with having no health benefits. And we wanted lifetime prescriptions for our retirees. You had guys 35 years, 37 years, 32 years walking around, limping around. Couldn't retire because they couldn't go without prescriptions, you know.
So that's where you feel the victory is?
That's where the victory was, you know. It never was a fight for these 24% wage increase. We know we weren't going to get that, you know, but we put it out there as a bargaining chip and for the real fight, and we did pretty good.
So when is the vote ultimate? How does it work right now?
It settled? It went to the E-Board, from what I understand, who voted it up, 85, I believe, to 10, something like that, you know, overwhelmingly. And then it goes to membership for ratification, and most likely membership will vote it up.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, Mark Albertan, with the Transit Workers Union, union shop steward, and also in the, on the telephone with us, Robert Snyder, author of Transit Talk, New York's Bus and Subway Workers Tell Their Stories. You are listening to Democracy Now! Looking around the world, nearly 120,000 workers seeking a wage increase staged a 24-hour strike yesterday that halted trains, buses, and streetcars around Italy, joining a string of job actions that In Germany, streetcar and subway drivers also went on strike, refusing to work until the government considered granting a 3% wage increase. You are listening to Democracy Now. Stay with us.
In the end, you'll still be you, one that's done all the things you set out to do. Stand. There's a cross for you to bear, things to go through if you're going anywhere. Things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
A midget standing tall, and the giant beside him about to fall.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Last Wednesday, Republican Senate Leader Trent Lott for the second time tried to distance himself from his remarks at Strom Thurmond's birthday party when he said the country would be better off if Thurmond had won the presidency on his Dixiecrat segregation forever platform in 1948. That same day, the Supreme Court held a hearing on whether states can ban cross-burning. Justice Clarence Thomas, who rarely utters a word in court, passionately denounced cross burnings. He said, "The cross was the symbol of this reign of terror for more than a century. There was no other purpose for the cross. It was intended to cause fear and terror." He went on to say, "It is unlike any symbol in our society." At issue is a 1952 Virginia law that makes it a crime to burn a cross or intimidate someone. Three white men in two separate cases were convicted of the offense in 1998. In one case, in August of 1998, some 20 people gathered on private land for a rally that concluded with Ku Klux Klan members setting on fire a 30-foot cross made of metal and covered in cloth. The leader of that group was Barry Elton Black, the leader of a Pennsylvania branch of the KKK, who preaches racial separatism and doesn't invite non-whites into his home. In another case, two Virginia men, Richard Elliott and Jonathan O'Mara, burnt a cross on the lawn of an African-American neighbor. All three men were convicted, but last year the Virginia Supreme Court ruled the state law was unconstitutional and reversed the convictions. Virginia prosecutors took the matter to the U.S. Supreme Court. Today we're going to have a debate on whether cross-burning should be constitutionally protected as free speech, or is it intimidating, simply meant to intimidate and harass? We are joined by John Powell, founder of the Institute on Race and Poverty at the University of Minnesota Law School, and Rodney Smola, law professor at the University of Richmond. He represented the three white Virginia men who burned the cross on their African-American neighbor's lawn, arguing that while a burning cross may be horrible, evil, and disgusting, it's no different from flag burning, and that it constitutes free expression. Rodney Smola, can you elaborate on that argument?
Well, I think it's important to know that we did not make the argument that there's a constitutional right to burn a cross. That is to say, certainly it is permissible for society to punish people who engage in threats and to punish hate crime, by which I mean punishments that are enhanced because the person commits the crime out of some form of bias, like racism or religious animosity. And so in any given instance, it's very possible that someone might burn a cross to threaten someone, to incite violence, or to engage in some other kind of crime that is motivated by racism. And society could punish those persons under neutral laws without offending the First Amendment. But what we said was wrong about the Virginia statute was that it singled out by name one symbol, the burning of the cross, and it effectively made that a kind of walking law violation, because even though the Virginia statute required an intent to intimidate, the statute also said that the mere burning of the cross is itself, standing alone, sufficient evidence to convict a person. It creates a presumption that you intend to intimidate someone. And the jury was instructed here that that's all they need to find, is that the cross was burned. And so for those reasons, we said you can have your cake and eat it too. You can accomplish everything you want to accomplish in combating the evil instances of cross burning without offending the First Amendment.
John Powell, your response.
Well, certainly, I think that the court, the Virginia Supreme Court's concern for the First Amendment is appropriate. But I think that in terms of cross burning, and particularly the situations you described, we have to put this in a context. Someone's burning a cross on your lawn. The court can certainly find that is intimidating, and in fact, there's a presumption of intimidation. I think very few people in America today or in America 20 years ago would believe that burning a cross on African Americans' lawn is less than intimidating. Now, are there some instances where you might burn a cross and it's not intimidating? Maybe. But what the statute really says is that given our history, given the Ku Klux Klan, given the intimidation of blacks in the South, there is a presumption that when someone burns a cross, that's what they are, the message that they are conveying, and that message is illegal. And I think that's perfectly appropriate. Now, can someone then burn a cross and prove that they weren't engaged in intimidation? If they can make that proof. But I don't think it's a matter of law we should say this statute is unconstitutional because it presumes that burning a cross is meant to intimidate. I think, in fact, that in fact is what it's meant to do, and in fact, I think in these cases, that's what it was doing.
Rodney Small.
Well, I think the problem with the argument is that when you abandon a neutral law, an ordinary threat law, or a hate crime law, which is also a form of neutral law for First Amendment purposes, and you create a presumption that a certain symbol or its desecration, the flag, the Star of David, a swastika, a cross, the image of Osama bin Laden, is so fraught with evil and danger because of the history that is attached to it, that you have to prove your innocence as opposed to the state proving your guilt, which is the normal requirement, that what you do is you invite a jury to punish the person, not because, in fact, they posed a threat of bodily harm to anyone on a given instance, but because of the odiousness of their message. I'll tell you that in the Ku Klux Klan case, one of the cases that was in front of the court, to me it is inconceivable that in reality anyone was in fact placed in any kind of threat of bodily harm by these Klan guys whooping it up, engaging in their traditional racist diatribe, attacking Hillary Clinton, attacking Bill Clinton, attacking the tax system, playing the hymn Amazing Grace, this bizarre melange of religious and political and social commentary, prejudice, hatred. You know, it's disgusting to most of us, but I don't think it put anybody in threat of bodily harm. Yet a jury here, in a matter of minutes, found that this was a threat. And they found it, I believe, not because it really was a threat, but because the state had, in effect, invited them to say, somebody burns a cross, boom, you can find that it's a threat. You don't even have to go any deeper.
John Powell.
A couple of things. First of all, you know, there are a lot of symbols. I mean, I think to the average listener, one might start and say, why is burning a cross speech at all? I mean, the way that we define the First Amendment, it's really a constitutional artifact. It's not anything obvious that makes burning a cross a speech. It's that part of it's a speech act. It's something you're engaged in. And if it has meaning, it's because of its historical context. Now, in a sense, I think it's almost misplaced to talk about this only in the context of the First Amendment. You know, this country had a very bloody war, and it had a history of slavery and a history of intimidation that was sanctioned by the government. Three constitutional amendments were passed, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, to change that. And we know by all the stuff that's been recently discussed about Lott that the change is not complete. And it seems to me that Justice Ginsburg was right when she said, you know, burning a cross is not the same as burning a flag. And if the only purpose, if the association of burning a cross is intimidation, then I think it is appropriate for a state to say, well, if you want to engage in this, you have to show that you're not falling within this larger historical context that everybody understands. Now, if you say, yeah, but no one was going to be hurt, it seems to me that misses the point. Intimidation is not simply that someone's about to be hit over the head. I mean, if you pull a gun on someone and aim it at them, and then you say, but the gun wasn't loaded, they weren't going to be hurt. It seems to me that misses the point. You pull a gun on someone, the presumption is that you're intimidating, that's going to hurt them. Now, there may be circumstances where you pull a gun on someone and you're playing and they know you're playing and there's no harm. But that doesn't change, the general perspective that when you pull a gun on someone, you can't defend yourself by saying there were no bullets in it.
John Powell, can you explain again why you believe you can't equate burning a cross with burning the flag?
Well, a couple of things. If you think about the sort of intimidation associated with burning a cross, which really gave rise, particularly after the Civil War, and the organized violence against blacks, the lynchings, it was directed at the very population that the Civil War amendments, particularly the 14th Amendment in this case, was designed to protect. And many of our civil rights laws and laws afterwards have been designed to protect it. And the country has been in this long battle around that. There have been black codes, and there have been 60 years of legalized segregation. We have nothing like that around the flag. The flag is a symbol for the entire country. Essentially, burning a cross and what that really represents is that some segment of our society, the freed slaves, if you will, don't belong, and we can use all kinds of forms to tell them they're not part of the polity and to threaten them if they move into our neighborhood, if they try to go to our schools. The flag means something very different. It's a symbol for all of us. It's not the symbol for a group that you burn the cross and then you lend someone. That's the association. There's nothing like that associated with flag burning.
Rodney Smola, your response to that.
Well, I have many levels of response, and I think the deepest disagreement that I have is that I am as committed to racial justice and as committed to the notion that the country is still living through the pains and the sins of a long history of entrenched racism as anyone. But I guess where I part with my colleague is that I think that a major part of the progress that the country has been able to make has been progress accomplished because of our robust protection for freedom of speech. And that includes not just verbal expression, the kind of intellectual debate we're having now, but it includes the kind of expression that I was arguing needs even more protection, arguably. Sit-ins, demonstrations, the waving of flags, the brandishing of symbols. I think that if you look back over the last 100 years, you will see that as often as not, people who are dispossessed, people who do not have a full place at the table, laborers, civil rights workers, war protesters, have needed the protection and have been blessed often by the protection of the First Amendment when they engaged in what my colleague has called speech acts, flags, demonstrations, marches, that kind of thing. And then turning to the gun and the flag just very quickly, first, you know, we all have to be careful about what we read into dialogues in oral argument in court. The justices, I think, were asking me questions, and there was a strong edge to their questions. But I'm not sure it meant that their minds were made up and that you can extrapolate from the questions that they asked that they're certain that they know the right answer, and it's not the answer I was giving. For example, Justice Scalia argued that brandishing a cross was like brandishing a gun. He put that question to me several times. And one response is that a gun is a weapon, and the fear that it instills, loaded or unloaded, comes from its physical properties as a weapon. A burning cross is a symbol, and the harm that comes from it comes from the meaning it has acquired over time. Symbols have meaning in the same way that words have meaning, through convention and usage and so on. A lot of the symbolic meaning of the cross does carry, at times, a meaning of threat, but it has all these other emanations, all these other meanings, and we can't pretend that they don't exist. The very last thing I'll say on the flag versus the cross burning, Justice Ginsburg's point, as I understood it when she was asking the question, was that when you burn the flag, you only show disrespect for the government, so it's a form of dissent. But when you burn the cross, you're attacking other human beings that are part of our community. And the reason I don't think it's such a clean distinction is that often the cross burners are also dissenting. They are dissenting against our policies on race. They're dissenting against policies that they think are wrong. And they're clearly, in many ways, putting it to the government as much as they are expressing their hatred of other people. And we may not agree with that message, but again, that's the point of the First Amendment. You can't silence people just because you don't agree with them.
John Powell, a lot to respond to there.
Well, you know, Amy, I also agree with my colleague that the First Amendment is important. And I think that to pose this question, that is, that if one believes that cross-burning can be limited by statute, suggests that one doesn't care about the First Amendment, is nothing could be further from the truth. I spent several years at the ACLU. I've written law review articles arguing for the First Amendment and arguing that the First Amendment and the 14th Amendment, the equality, anti-discrimination portion of our Constitution, are not inconsistent. But what I do think is problematic is when we take, and I'm not saying my colleague is doing that, but I think there's an assumption that the First Amendment can mechanically be applied, that it can be applied outside of context, and that it trumps everything else. And that's what I think is wrong. Certainly, I think the First Amendment protects us. And one of the ways it protects us is to allow our voice and our full participation in society. It's about giving voice to all of us. Many of the examples that he gave in terms of unions and marches were really about people trying to be part of society. Now, there are going to be dissents. This is not simply about people having differences. And the question of speech, and I don't want to get too far into this, but the question of speech is a very technical question, but there's some things that are very simple. We're not the only society in the world that care about free speech and equality. Virtually everyone does. And they all draw the line, frankly, differently than we do. It doesn't mean they don't care about free speech. But I think we have to really listen to and think about what is being said. If you say, I think the president should die, that speech, is it protected or not? Maybe not, because it's also an act. It also can be interpreted as intimidation. It becomes, in some sense, a factual question. But we have laws saying you can't threaten the president, and you can't defend that constitutionally by simply saying, I'm expressing my dissent. Yes, you can express your dissent, but there are boundaries. And part of those boundaries is we're not allowed to intimidate others. We're not allowed to threaten others. And to engage in an act of cross-burning and then say, but we're not about intimidations, I think to me is really disingenuous and doesn't make someone who is troubled by that speech act anti-First Amendment. I'm very strongly in favor of the First Amendment, but I'm also very strongly in favor of prohibiting and stopping the intimidation of African Americans, of immigrants, of other marginalized people in our society.
Well, I want to thank you both for being on with us. Rodney Smola, law professor at University of Richmond Law School, who represented those that burned the crosses before the Supreme Court. I have to ask, what was it like hearing Clarence Thomas, the normally very reticent Supreme Court justice, speak out?
It was powerful, and I was very moved by his remarks, and I was actually glad that they came out and we got that out into the open so we could contend with it. Whether I did or not, I don't know, but certainly I said to Justice Thomas, I credit and believe in everything you're saying, but think we can attack it through neutral laws.
And John Powell, maybe it's an unrelated question, I don't know, but why do you spell your name in all lower cases?
When African Americans were changing their names in the 60s, and particularly Muhammad Ali, I thought of doing the same, and I was named after my mother's father, and she was upset that I was going to do that, feeling that I was disaffiliating with the family. So it was a way of basically maintaining the deep family connection and at the same time claiming the name for my own.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. And John Powell, one quick question. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal of today. It says Charles Pickering's hopes of a second chance at Senate approval of his nomination to a U.S. appeals court are all but doomed by the troubles of his chief sponsor, Senate Republican leader Trent Lott. Any comments on what Pickering represented?
I think that's very good. I think not just Pickering, but there are a number of court nominees that have very troubling records on civil rights, on issues, on women's issues, on immigration that are being pushed through. And I think that this invites a chance for us to look at this in a much larger context. It invites us to really have a more robust discussion about not just liberty, but equality and inclusion. But I think Pickering's article about anti-miscegenation, his voting on the court now, his record on the court now, to me makes it clear that he is not the person to represent all American people on the court. Let me just say one final thing about the First Amendment, and I've said this before. I believe that the Bill of Rights are not neutral. I think they're about a democratic society. I think they're about inclusion. I think they're about dissent, but they're not neutral. The First Amendment is not about neutrality. 14th Amendment is not about neutrality. There are values attached to those, and they're very important values. And I think Pickering and others, in my mind, don't reflect those values.
Well, thank you again for being with us, John Powell, founder of the Institute on Race and Poverty at University of Minnesota Law School. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to take a look at some information that has leaked out on the internet about government officials. Some are saying if they can gather information on the rest of us, there's nothing wrong with putting out information on them. What do you think? Stay with us. Years, Peter Tosh, here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. the head of the government's Total Information Awareness Project, which aims to track credit card, travel, medical, school, and other records of everyone in the United States, has himself become a target of personal data profiling. According to a recent article in Wired.com, online pranksters taking their lead from a San Francisco journalist are publishing John Poindexter's home phone number, photos of his house, and other personal information to protest the surveillance program. The campaign began after columnist Matt Smith printed the information, which he says is all publicly available, in a recent column for the SF Weekly. Smith wrote, "Optimistically, I dialed John and Linda Poindexter's number. He gave their number, gave their address, hoping the good admiral and excused criminal might be able to offer some insight." Smith continued, "Why, for example, is their $269,700 Rockville, Maryland house covered with artificial siding, according to Maryland's tax records? Shouldn't a Reagan conspirator be able to afford repainting every 7 years?" Smith added, "I needed to call Poindexter anyway, and it seemed like a worthy concept that if he's going to be compiling data that most certainly will leak around to other departments and get used, one way to get readers to think about it was to turn that around." Well, Matt Smith joins us right now from the San Francisco Weekly. He's author of the recent piece, "The International Poindextering of Poindexter." Can you talk more about your conversation with the Poindexter household?
Well, it was... Hello, Amy.
It's good to have you with us.
It was a pretty brief conversation. I called and said, "Is this the home of Admiral John Poindexter?" It was Linda Poindexter, I think, that answered. She said yes, but that she was on another call and that could she leave a message, and or could I call back in 15 minutes? I called back, left a couple messages, and wasn't able to get through, but that was the extent. Evidently, another reader had a more extended conversation with her about collecting and archiving people's toll booth records and other things. Is kind of, and then he wrote us a letter that we ran on the letters page. So it seemed like there was at least one conversation before they shut their phone off, because we got a bunch of other letters saying I can't get through. It says the phone's been cut off. So seems like they did speak to a few
citizens. You asked, is the Donald Douglas Poindexter listed in Maryland sex offender records any relation to the good admiral?
I didn't ask her that. No, I didn't. Like I say, I didn't really get a chance to have a deep and fruitful conversation.
Li Tian is also on the telephone with us. Li Tian is senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I think he just slipped off the line. But Medea Benjamin is here as well. In Washington, the Secret Service yesterday warned a group of peace activists against convening in front of War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's home tonight in Washington. Activists were planning to gather there to sing holiday carols. Can you talk, Medea Benjamin, about what the Secret Service said?
Well, they called us up and they said that they were very, very upset with us, that Donald Rumsfeld had hit the roof when he found out we were putting out on the Internet to meet a block and a half away from his home and then walk down to his home to Christmas carol, and told us that the FBI was going to turn the heat on the women's vigil and investigate every link that we had, and really made us feel that somehow Christmas caroling was bordering on the line of terrorism.
Just an interesting historic note. Tonight's gathering won't be the first time peace activists have taken protest directly to Rumsfeld's home. Well, just a few weeks ago, about more than half the town of Taos, New Mexico, went outside Rumsfeld's home. But during the Ford administration, the late Philip Berrigan once dug a grave on the lawn of Donald Rumsfeld, who then, too, was serving as the nation's war secretary. The headline in the next day's paper read, "Berrigan arrested at Rumsfeld's grave."
Amy, I should also put it in the context of the fact that we have tried to reach and meet with everybody from Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld, during our month-long vigil in front of the White House, we've put in many, many calls to the Pentagon to try to meet with Rumsfeld, and they just kind of laugh and say, yeah, sure. So our public officials refuse to meet with us in their workplaces. I think we have the right to go to their homes.
Li Qian is with us, Senior Staff Attorney at Electronic Frontier Foundation. Your thoughts on giving out Poindexter and Rumsfeld's addresses and phone numbers? And then can you tell us what's happening in the nation's airports, something that's even more together at this point than the Total Information Awareness Program of John Poindexter?
Well, I think that this idea or tactic of disseminating public officials publicly available information is something that has happened before. You know, there have been incidents where people have tried to or have succeeded in gaining copies of public officials' credit reports through sort of simple investigative techniques, doing the kinds of things that a private eye would do. So it's not something that's new or sort of big and different from what's been done before. And, of course, it is public record information, and it is the sort of thing that shows how any of us, unless we take really, really special precautions, can have quite a bit of our lives exposed because it's out there in the data, which is precisely what makes these kinds of data valence programs so scary. Most people don't think about the implications of this sort of thing, and as long as someone is simply making a peaceful protest in front of someone's home on a sidewalk, I don't see any problem with this. This is a common tactic in, in the abortion wars, for instance, where people have stood in front of the homes of doctors who perform abortions and this sort of thing, and in general. When there's not any kind of disruption, there's a speech element there. But with a public official, it's especially important. You know, you wouldn't say that you couldn't, protest or stand silently in front of the White House.
What about the issue of airports right now?
Now, the airport stuff, that's the most interesting thing that's going on right now. In fact, one of the reasons that our group, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is very concerned about this Poindexter program is that it's distracting us from what's really going on at airports. Since about 1997, there's been a form of computer-assisted passenger pre-screening at airports, but after September 11th, it's gone into totally high gear, and what they contemplate is being able to instantly sort of fuse and do in real time a study of every passenger who's on the manifest of a plane, and to look at their airline reservation records, their complete flight records, histories, hotel reservation histories, rental car, credit card transaction receipts, a huge amount of information which is not all publicly available. Much of it lies in the hands of credit reporting agencies, the sort of stuff you might find on your credit report, and they are going to score people and decide whether or not, how big of a risk they are. They'll be looking, right now they look at about 24 variables, like whether your flight was one way, whether you bought your ticket in cash, how soon it was, how close it was to the time of your flight. They're going to be looking at roughly 1,000 variables now. And this program was supposed to have come into effect this year. They're behind because it's a harder job than they think to do all this kind of data valence. But they've got some very, very big companies and collaborations of companies out there. A company called HNC Software in San Diego that specializes in neural network software that learns and has been used to do fraud detection.
Well, we're going to have to continue this discussion another time. We're out of time, and I want to thank you, Li Qian of Electronic Frontier Foundation, Medea Benjamin, who's going to be protesting outside Donald Rumsfeld's house tonight, and Matt Smith of the San Francisco Weekly. Thanks for joining us. Democracy Now!'s website is democracynow.org. You can call for audio or video cassettes of today's show, 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, and Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. 400 years.